Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Mystery Babylon News Radio on Sunday, March 3rd, 2013. This broadcast is a book review of Ecclesiastical Megalomania by John W. Robbins. My guest Tom Frest of First Amendment Radio will start the broadcast reading the preface of this book. This is a 10-minute recording of Tom reading it on his broadcast on First Amendment Radio, February 8, 2013. He is currently reading the book on his broadcast. Now, here is a recording of the preface.
Now, I'll read the preface. Very important information in the preface of this book. 150 years ago, the English historian Thomas Babington Macaulay, who lived from 1800 to 1859, wrote, quote, "There is not and never was on this earth a work of human policy so well deserving of examination as the Roman Catholic Church," unquote. The Roman Church State, and notice this is a consistent convention of this author to regard as the Roman Catholic Church, not as simply a church, but a church state. The Roman Catholic Church is a state and a church. It is not itself if the state is separate from the church and the church separate from the state. We've talked repeatedly that the only form of government that the papacy recognizes is a church-state system, where the church controls the state. The state simply does the bidding of the church. The state is an intermediary between the church or the pope and the people. Okay. Now, the Roman church state is the oldest institution continually in existence, tracing its roots at least to the 6th century, and if one believes the Church's own claims, to the time of Christ himself. For much of that time, it has been the most powerful institution in Europe, and though its fortunes fell after the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, it has made a remarkable resurgence in the past century. In addition to being the world's oldest institution, the Roman Church State is also the world's largest, numbering over 1 billion subjects. That's with a B, 1/6 of the planet's population. One Roman Catholic priest in America, comparing his church to a corporation, wrote, quote, "The Catholic Church must be the biggest corporation in the United States. We have a branch office in every neighborhood. Our assets and real estate holdings must exceed those of Standard Oil, AT&T, and U.S. Steel combined. And our roster of dues-paying members must be second only to the tax rolls of the United States government." This was a quote from Richard Grinder, was quoted in Nino Lobello's work, Vatican USA, and I have a copy of that book and have verified the truth of that quote. Let me read it again. "The Catholic Church must be the biggest corporation in the United States. We have a branch office in every neighborhood." That would be the Roman Catholic Churches, right? "Our assets and real estate holdings must exceed those of Standard Oil, AT&T, and U.S. Steel combined. And our roster of dues-paying members must be second only to the tax rolls of the United States government," unquote. Worldwide, of course, the Roman Church State's roster of members ranks behind the entire populations of only 2 nations, China and India. Do you comprehend the power? If you don't admit the power of the Roman Catholic Church, at least you must admit the potential for power of the Roman Catholic Church, since its dues-paying members are only exceeded by the populations of China and India. Okay, that'd give you some concept of how many people in the world the Pope represents. And if you throw in on top of that all those who have acquiesced to the authority of the papacy since Vatican Council II and this ecumenical movement to unite all of the religions of the world under the Pope's authority, you have a whopping, controlling mandate for the papacy. But just the information that we've received from this author, having to do with the power of the Roman Catholic Church in this world, in the United States and in the world, it's enough for us to take special observation of this church and what its policies are. The author continues, he says, in addition to being the world's oldest, largest, most powerful, and most influential political, ecclesiastical institution, there's that church state again, the Roman church state must also be the world's wealthiest. It is the wealthiest. Certainly considered merely as a church, it is the world's wealthiest institution. Only the assets of a handful of civil governments might surpass its massive wealth. It is very difficult to ascertain the assets of the Roman church state. The organization does not report its holdings to anyone, including its members. And researchers who have endeavored to discover its riches have found no limits to them, only to their ability to see the horizon. And if you're a regular listener to Inquisition Update, you heard this also by Avril Manhattan when we read the book, The Vatican Billions. The assets of the Roman Catholic Church are literally incalculable. Now, that seems to be an exaggeration, but it's true. Incalculable. And that's partly the reason why the Vatican doesn't report its assets. They simply can't enumerate them. Now, according to canon law, now we've been talking about canon law, haven't we, in the papacy and the civil power. This is the basis legal structure, the laws under which the church is bound. This is to be the law of the world. After all, it's considered divine and infallible. It says, according to canon law, the control of all property of the Roman church state belongs to the Pope, its supreme emperor. And the author gives us a note here, and I'll read it. Canon 1273 provides that, quote, by virtue of his primacy and governance of the Roman pontiff is the supreme administrator and steward of all ecclesiastical goods, unquote. Canon 332 provides that, quote, the Roman pontiff obtains full and supreme power in the church by means of legitimate election by the College of Cardinals, accepted by him together with episcopal consecration, unquote. The Pope is not bound by any promises he made to the College of Cardinals in order to be elected Pope. Quote, the current rules of the conclave state that the Pope is not bound by any promises he made to get votes, even if he promised under oath, unquote. That's from Thomas J. Rees, the Jesuit priest, who wrote the book Inside the Vatican, The Politics and Organization of the Catholic Church, published by Harvard University Press in 1996, from page 69 of the work. And, quote, once a pope is elected, his election cannot be invalidated, even if he bought the election, unquote. Again, from the same work, Inside the Vatican, page 100. And the Pope's power is absolute. The Pope's power is absolute. Now, continuing with the text, it says, that property includes tens of thousands of buildings, millions of acres of land, tons of gold and silver and precious stones, art collections, rare documents, and millions of shares in business corporations throughout the globe. since the Roman Church State is an even more formidable organization than it was at the time Macaulay wrote. This study of her economic and political thought needs no further explanation or justification. What does require some explanation, however, is the relative lack of attention to the Roman Church State by serious non-Catholic scholars. Most of the works quoted in this book were written by Roman Catholics. The world of American scholarship seems to have partitioned itself, at least with regard to the study of the Roman Church State, so that the study of the Roman Church State has been reserved for Roman Catholics. Perhaps it is the fear of being labeled anti-Catholic that has dissuaded some non-Catholic scholars from writing about the church state, a fear that undermines all scholarship. Now, here is another note from the author. It says the same sort of fear of losing their academic reputations and respectability dissuaded some scholars for much of the 20th century from writing critically about communism, both in America and in other nations. To do so would have cost them at least their reputations, if not their jobs. The only permissible critics of communism were communists and socialists. Academia, like Hollywood, far from being neutral, disinterested, or unbiased, is ruled by intellectual goon squads. The phenomenon of political correctness originated and flourished in the universities long before the phenomenon had been named. And it is politically incorrect to criticize the Roman Catholic Church, and that's why non-Catholics steer clear of it. That is, non-Catholics accept Inquisition Update on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Criticism of the Roman Catholic Church State is our business. Exposing the biblical, historical, and prophetic Antichrist to warn God's people.
Greetings and welcome to Mystery Babylon News Radio. And welcome to the broadcast, Tom.
Good evening, Walt. Well, nice to be here, and good evening to your listeners.
Well, anyway, started listening to you read the book on the air, and you started on February 8th, and for anybody listening, you can go to First Amendment Radio and Inquisition Update and check the archives, and you can get caught up with this book. This book, like you and I have shared off air, we learn in waves, and yes. I think this one here, with my prior knowledge, it kind of makes some of the other books not as important as this one here. And one thing I want to start with tonight is on the back of the book. On the last paragraph, he says, ecclesiastical megalomania explains the conflict between Roman Catholicism and freedom in detail, relying on official Vatican pronouncements to demonstrate that Roman Catholicism is hostile to constitutional government, political and economic freedom, and the private property order. The Mother Church is the mother of feudalism, corporative state, liberation theology, welfare state, and fascism. Those who wish to preserve human freedom must understand the philosophy of the Roman Catholic Church. And, you know, to start with, Tom, you know, I the word communism, we've been hit from it from especially baby boomers like myself and right after World War II. I'd like to have you give us a little background on communism and like starting with the socialist communist reductions in Paraguay. Could you give us comments?
Well, what we know today is communism or socialism, collectivism, was a form of government that the Jesuits experimented with when they operated their reductions in Paraguay. They made slaves out of the Indians in Paraguay, and they formed units of work or communities, you might call them, called reductions. And the Jesuits controlled all the land and all the means of production, and the Indians were required to work a certain amount of time every day in the fields, and for their part, they were given all their basic needs, and the Jesuits actually used what was left over to market in Europe. It was an experiment on a particular form of government that the Jesuits simply imported to Russia and communism afterwards. So communism really kind of finds, or socialism, collectivism kind of finds its roots in with the Jesuits in the Paraguayan reductions. And you can look up Paraguayan reductions or Paraguay in Wikipedia and read about them for yourself. But communism is essentially where the government controls the land and also the means of production. And the people are given their basic needs, and the government has all the power.
Okay. Tom, also, could you give us the relationship between communism and how it relates to Catholicism?
Well, Roman Catholicism, as we might or might not know, depending on how much we know about history, the Roman Catholic Church controlled the land during the Dark Ages, and vast amounts of land, so much so that without that land, the nations couldn't survive. I think there was a period in England where the Vatican actually controlled at least one-third of the arable land in England. And the Roman Catholic Church was the biggest power to deal with. And the monks ran, and the blue blood families of the Roman Catholic Church ruled the land for the papacy, and the people were serfs. And they were reduced to ignorance. Most people couldn't read. And they simply served the church day in, day out. And that was their life. That was the feudal system. And the Protestant Reformation liberated the people from that. People no longer had to serve the church, and they could use their own resources and their own land to build their own riches. And with those riches, they educated themselves, sent their kids to college to teach them how to read so they could read the Bible that was available for the first time in history, or at least the history that they were aware of, that they could read the Bible for themselves in their own language. And out of that came liberation and individuality, the realization that the people were the church, that they were the vessels, the temples of the Holy Spirit, and God wrote his law within their hearts and gave them the scriptures. Christ was king, and the people obeyed. And because of that liberty, having shed the chains, the iron chains of slavery from the Roman Catholic Church, they then had their own resources with which to do, and that brought us the modern era, and production and education and affluence, and poverty was an exception rather than the rule.
Well, in modern day, too, we hear the term liberation theology. An example is our President Obama was under tutorage of Jeremiah Wright there at the church he came out of, and Jeremiah Wright was tutored in liberation theology. Could you tell us how that fits into our and kind of meshes with communism?
Yes, well, I'm not an expert on liberation theology, but it's just another means of what I call a transition period, because the current modern era is transitioning into what we call the New World Order. And the Pope has a complete new plan for economics, for the social world, for politics, and religion, as a matter of fact. And liberation theology, while many people say that the papacy is against it, liberation theology was created by the Jesuit order. And maybe someday I'll get a chance to do more research on liberation theology so I can really describe it better for the listeners. But it fits right into the Pope's New World Order. And what characterizes the New World Order is a global collective. Global communism or global socialism, and a mixture of communism, socialism, and fascism. And the Pope literally has made himself a global Robin Hood, where he is leveling the playing field, taking from the rich and giving to the poor, and we get to call it charity.
You know, what grabbed me about the preface of the book, the start of the book, is my when I'm out in the secular world and I, you know, and people are talking politics, I like to ask the question, what is the largest business in the world? And people kind of bounce around on it, you know, but the largest business in the world is religion.
Yes.
And then when we, and of course, what was so pronounced with in the first part of the book is because this came from a Catholic source, from a Catholic priest that recognized that Catholicism is the biggest corporation in the world.
Yes.
And the reason why we don't see this and we see it as a religion is because if we took the cloak of religion off of this and looked at them as men in suits, bankers, you know, corporate. I mean, because
be an economic colossus. It would be an economic colossus.
Yes.
If we replace the popes and the bishops' frocks with business suits and treated them like everyone else, we'd call it a monopoly, a religious economic monopoly.
Well, I was listening to a broadcast today, and they were talking about imperialism. You know, and they talked about what is going on in the world, but never talking about who. And they talked about corporations, and the corporations are the ones that are behind imperialism, but they never mentioned the largest one, because
the largest corporation is the Roman Catholic Church, and imperialism is a global empire that's being established by the papacy in the New World Order.
And with them at the top.
With them at the top, that's right.
Yes.
Well, the papacy, let me just reduce it down to a single phrase that everybody can realize, that can remember. The New World Order makes the Pope the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Supreme sovereign ruler of the world in economics, social, political, and religious.
There's a little piece out of, Obama is Rome in the world economy, perhaps most significant to the Obama administration was the Pope's handing Obama his economic encyclical letter titled, go ahead, Tom, how do you pronounce that?
It's pronounced Caritas in Veritate, okay, which means charity and truth. It's Latin for charity and truth.
It's the Pope's encyclical, which is the highest form of papal writing called for reform of the United Nations and financial bodies, giving them the real teeth needed to tackle economic and social injustice. Terms like economic and social injustice are typically associated with Marxist ideology. Meanwhile, the Brisbane News posted an article titled Pope Calls for a New World Order, saying Pope Benedict XVI has proposed a new world political authority with real teeth, possibly in place of the United Nations to enforce an ethical financial order and end the global financial crisis. I did have, and I decided not to play it because it was a very poor quality, But Obama, in October of 1998 at Loyola University in Chicago, made this this statement. He said, "I think the trick is figuring out how do we structure government systems that pool resources and hence facilitate some redistribution, because I actually believe in redistribution, at least at certain level, to make sure that everybody has got a shot. How do we pool resources at the same time as we decentralize delivery systems in ways that both foster competition, can work in the marketplace, and can foster innovation at the local level and can be tailored to particular communities?" Now, this was referring, but this was back in 1998, speaking at a Jesuit university. If I ask you, do you think that this is Obama's idea, or maybe it's the encyclical?
Well, absolutely not. He's taking language directly out of the encyclical. And the Jesuits at Loyola University in Chicago knew precisely what he was talking about. He was speaking their language. He was speaking the language of Caritas in Veritate, charity and truth, the global redistribution of the world's wealth. And they call it the universal destination of goods. And it's a command to the governments of the world to structure government systems in order to facilitate the redistribution of that nation's wealth. See, the papacy says that it looks at the world and it sees the haves and the have-nots. Let me first describe who the haves are. The Protestants, who were liberated from the papacy 500 years ago, no longer bound by the iron chains of Rome, no longer feudal serfs, but were industrialists. And economic colossus resulted from it. The United States, Britain, and Australia, and other Protestant nations are a glowing example of success in the world. But you compare them side by side with the traditional and historic Roman Catholic countries of the world, there's a stark and rather embarrassing difference between the Protestant nations and the Roman Catholic nations. The Roman Catholic nations are poor and illiterate. They're slaves of the priests. And it's simply a continuation, basically, of the feudal system. Now, some of the modern world has crept in, obviously. But there's a, you know, you can simply, in some places of Ireland, you can go from a Protestant area of the country into a Roman Catholic area. It's like going back to the Dark Ages. And this is an embarrassment to the Roman Catholic Church. It makes Protestantism look like the success that it really is. And so the papacy, in this facade of charity and concern for the poor, he wants to take from the rich Protestant nations and redistribute that wealth to the poor third world nations. And of course, he's got the support of all the third world nations who stand to gain financially and in every other way from the Pope's charity, when in fact it's not charity at all. It's theft. The Bible says, "Thou shalt not steal," and "Thou shalt not covet." Well, the papacy is simply putting himself in a position to take the wealth of the nations and then redistribute them. And it's going to be not just nations, but whole communities, and right down to the individual level. It's called subsidiarity. And this is what Obama is talking about here. How do we structure the government to pool resources and facilitate the redistribution of the wealth? He's taking this literally right out of the papal encyclical. We have a president of the United States who has essentially made Roman Catholicism the official religion of this country without declaring it. And he's organizing our government to facilitate the redistribution of this nation's wealth to third world nations at the behest of the papacy. And now they want to decentralize delivery systems for our resources and put them in the marketplace. In other words, make non-governmental agencies a part of this. In other words, they're going to bring it right down to street level. Your local city government is going to participate in this. It's not going to be the federal government. It's going to be your local communities are going to be doing this. Local, county, state, and federal, right down to street level. And what they have planned is to assess everyone's personal property. They're going to tell us what we need, and then they're going to take the rest of it, and they're going to redistribute it to the poor. And also part of this plan is if someone comes by your house and sees something that you have that they need, that need preempts your title to that property. And it literally becomes the property of the need. The Pope calls this a social mortgage, which preempts or is superior to literal title to property.
And they're putting this into motion over the whole world right now.
Yes. The governments that are going along with the Pope's New World Order are putting this into practice. You've heard...
Well, the reason that I bring this up is I've been listening to Australian radio. Mm-hmm. And in other words, it's like they're describing this encyclical. In other words, they're not mentioning this, but this plan is this same plan is being implemented onto Australia and onto the whole world. Giving an example, Australia has to import fish from Africa. They have more coastline and fishing than any other country, except they've been throttled by environmental laws, and now they have to import fish. Yeah. And in other words, we're doing this, and they've done the same thing to us. Yeah. I mean, we can't even build a shovel in this country.
Yeah,
and it's been done through this. This is what they're talking about in this encyclical is exactly what is being implemented as we speak. That's
yes, it's been being implemented for 20 years. It's already in place.
Yes,
they're just telling us now what it is.
Yes.
It's all a response to the Pope. It's all a response to papal encyclicals like Rerum Novarum. That's the big one. Rerum Novarum and Caritas in Veritate and others. And the author of this book, Ecclesiastical Megalomania, his name is John W. Robbins. He gives us these encyclicals and takes the language right out of these encyclicals and shows them how the governments of the world are implementing
these
encyclicals.
It's such an eye opener, because they have their game plan right out in front of us, but people cannot see it, because when they look at the Roman Catholic Church, they're thinking of it as a church.
They have the Protestant model of individual churches being individual churches, but the Roman Catholic Church is an extension of the Vatican, just like you heard the quote earlier in the broadcast, that they have a branch office in every neighborhood. Vatican has a branch office in every neighborhood. They're not independent churches. They're owned by the Pope.
No.
It's part of a global system. Each Roman Catholic Church is just a branch office of the global Roman Catholic Church.
And in other words, they use the religion for control and influence.
Yes,
and so the American Catholic and the American Protestant, we're all in this together. I mean, in other words, if the American Catholic and the American Protestant really realized what was going on, their game would be over overnight.
Yes, they would rebel against it, and that's why I'm reading this book on the air. Hopefully,
I highly recommend that you go to Tom's broadcast, get into the archives, and get picked up on this, because this is a very, very important book. Tom, I would like to move on to something. This is another thing that struck me when I was listening to your broadcast. You mentioned education. Now, at this time, I would like to start the the recording here. This is on the 26th of February on your broadcast. It's two minutes and 21 seconds. So let's go ahead and listen to this.
And strip the libraries of the schools of any history of the Roman Catholic Church. You know, Fox's Book of Martyrs used to be required reading. The teachings of the Protestant Reformers was required reading. True history used to be required reading. And there was a natural aversion and suspicion of the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church. That has all been stripped from the school libraries. That's now considered hate speech.
Greetings and good evening. To many, history might be dry and boring. Yet if we have a burning desire to understand what is truth, then history becomes a vibrant and alive. History sheds light on our present world and also gives understanding for the future. It is through history that we find our roots and has become the reason and object of why much of our history today has been thoroughly censored, so that our roots will be purposely obscured.
Divisiveness. And now Rome has won the day in education. It says this means that true freedom in education requires civil society, that is the government, to subsidize religious schools. The Roman Catholic Church state made this even clearer when it said, quote, policy decision should not allow for the existence of alternative educational systems, including, but not limited to, charter schools, magnet schools, and public, private, and religious school choice programs, provided they offer quality programs that do not teach or practice intolerance or advocate illegal activity, unquote. Did you catch that? They cannot allow churches, or rather schools, that offer teaching that the Roman Catholic Church determines is intolerance. In other words, you can't have a Protestant school because the Roman Catholic Church determines that that is intolerance.
Tom, I'm coming to a point on education. What I'm trying to clarify here is what has changed from 2013 to 1776. In 1776. The Roman Catholic Church in Protestant colonies, in Protestant England, didn't have any credibility. Could you at this time read the Royal Declaration, what the king, after the Glorious Revolution of 1688, and they set it all the way up until the 1900s? Could you read that to us?
Yes, this is from the 1912 Catholic Encyclopedia. It's called the Old Catholic Encyclopedia. This is the Royal Declaration. This is the oath taken by the Queen or the King of England before he took the throne. This was a Protestant nation, and they understood that the Roman Catholic Church would do everything in their power to get control of the crown, get control of the throne of England to make the country Catholic. And so to protect their Protestantism, to keep the papacy out of the throne, they produced this oath, and I'll read it as it is. Quote, I be, that is first name, last name, by the grace of God, King or Queen of England, Scotland, and Ireland, defender of the faith, do solemnly and sincerely in the presence of God, profess, testify, and declare that I do believe that in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper there is not any transubstantiation of the elements of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ, at or after the consecration thereof by any person whatsoever, and that the invocation or adoration of the Virgin Mary or any other saint and the sacrifice of the Mass as they are now used in the Church of Rome are superstitious and idolatrous. And I do solemnly in the presence of God profess, testify, and declare that I do make this declaration and every part thereof in the plain and ordinary sense of the words read unto me, as they are commonly understood by English Protestants. without any evasion, equivocation, or mental reservation whatsoever, and without any dispensation already granted me by the Pope or any other authority or person whatsoever, or without any hope of any such dispensation from any person or authority whatsoever, or without thinking that I am or can be acquitted by God or man, or absolved from this declaration or any part thereof, although the Pope or any other person or persons or power whatsoever should dispense with or annul the same, or declare that it was null and void from the beginning. That is the oath taken by the King or Queen of England when they ascend the throne. And it is a specific denunciation of the tenets of papacy. And it also contains a guarantee or an oath that they will not use the shrewd and deceptive equivocation and mental reservation that the Jesuits teach Roman Catholics in order to evade having to obey an oath like this.
And now the reason that I brought this to the attention is you know, this is the history that has never been taught to us. This country was the colonies were 99% Protestant, and what we got out of the founding of this country is we got a universal government with Protestant principles, but we didn't get a Protestant government, but we did get the Protestant principles. This is one part of the history. So when you see the word today, the way when somebody says the word Christian, they automatically, the Catholics are considered Christians.
Yes. But England did not consider Catholicism Christianity.
No,
or there never would have been an oath like this.
That's right. What I'm trying to say is it legitimized 1776, made Catholics Christian, and the ecumenical movement was started.
And essentially, yes, not in name, but in principle. Yes,
in principle. In other words, what I'm getting at here to the listeners, Tom, and it's something that you learn this in waves. I mean, and when it hits you, it'll hit you awful hard. Understand what we see on the streets. There's a corporation in every city in our country. That was illegal prior to 1776 and was considered an idolatrous, superstitious religion. Mm-hmm. And that is what the Reformation gives us. And the only light that we have with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is those Protestant principles.
Yes.
And our Catholic listeners, I mean, they're Catholic, but they've been raised with Protestant principles, and there's a lot
Protestant
of American
liberty.
Catholics.
That's right. There are a lot of American Catholics that if they understood exactly what the papacy is implementing, not only in this country but around the world, they would rebel against this. They would rebel against the Pope's New World Order, just as the French Catholics did, called the Gallicans. They
right.
didn't mind the Pope being the spiritual leader of their church, but they did not want the papacy to have anything to do with their government. They wanted the papacy, they wanted to strip the papacy of all of his temporal power, his political power.
The motive that we're trying to put across is really to understand this. This book that we book review tonight covers this very, very thoroughly.
Yes,
and it's something that that in other words, this message is not anti-Catholic. This is very pro-Bible.
That's right.
And so, with that, Tom, we've run out of time. Thanks for coming, Tom, and we'll see you next week.
My pleasure.